Spider-Man does whatever a spider can. Spins a web any size, catches thieves just like flies. Look out, here comes the Spider-Man. Is he strong?
Good evening, ladies, gentlemen, MBs. I'm Shaden, this is Waridesh Show, and these are my semi-coherent thoughts on Spider-Man No Way Home. So if you've only got a few minutes to spare because you're on a lunch break, driving home, or defusing a bomb, in which case, good luck, I'll sum up quickly what I thought of the film. It was good, but it was also bad. But overall, good. I definitely recommend it for people who like Spider-Man stuff in general. I mean, no surprises there. But I can say with certainty that it isn't as good as Into the Spider-Verse, despite sharing kind of the same concept. But it's also not bad. You'll also get more out of it if you've seen the Sam Raimi Spider-Man films and the ones made by Mark Webb, although, by all accounts, this movie has made enough money to finance a small country, so odds are pretty good you've already seen it, but if not, it's enjoyable enough and worth your time. It's good! So I should probably establish some bona fides first. I did see the original Raimi trilogy back when they came out at the cinemas in the 2000s, which, now that I think about it, feels like a century ago, but whatever. I haven't, however, seen any of the Mark Webb Spider-Man films with Andrew Garfield, because even back then when they were in development, I was aware of the behind-the-scenes tumult with Sony exercising creative control, air quotes, of what Sam Raimi wanted to do with Spider-Man 3 by needlessly crowbarring in Venom, for example. I mean, I'm sure glad that won't happen again, right? Right? Anyway, yeah, I never watched the Mark Webb films as I was deeply cynical over Sony's previous meddling and general approach. Plus, the critical reception around them wasn't all that great. So this puts me in a kind of curious position that I'll explain more later on. Also, I have seen Homecoming, I have seen Far From Home, the 90s animated series, and Into the Spider-Verse. I know a little bit about Spider-Man's history in the comics, but never read much of them beyond one or two event comics in which he appeared, so that's that, really. Spoiler warning is also now in effect, so if you've yet to see the film, you've 3 seconds or so to turn this off before I reveal a major plot point that I kinda have to in order to even explain what's going on in the film. So, 3, 2, 1. Tobey Maguire and Andrew Garfield are in the film as their respective Peter Parkers. And so for the sake of simplicity when discussing their characters, I'm just going to refer to the actors by name rather than trying to keep to Peter Parker 1, 2, or 3 as the film does, or some other nonsensical labelling system. You got that? Good. Let's get cracking. Part 1. No powers, no responsibilities. So, No Way Home finally has a character recite the mantra that is probably as well known in pop culture as May the Force be with you, that of course being with great power comes great responsibility. It's been a constant in every iteration of Spider-Man that I've personally seen, from the 90s animated series to Raimi's films and beyond. And for a moral base for a superhero, it's actually a pretty good and simple one. Which is why it's a shame that No Way Home kinda mangles it for Tom Holland's Peter Parker. The character in question who says this to him is Aunt May, played by Marissa Tomei, of course, shortly before she dies. Dies, that is, from being hit by Willem Dafoe's Green Goblin glider, and this is in the context of her previously telling Tom Holland that he simply cannot just send the various villains of the film back to their own realities only to then die themselves fighting their respective Spider-Men, but he must try to cure them of their ailments, that this is the moral thing to do, which, I mean, sure, I get that, but there is something amiss with all of this. You see, in the first Raimi film, it is Tobey Maguire's Uncle Ben who recites that phrase, but it's in the context of him just fearing his nephew has suddenly grown strong or confident enough to swap from being bullied to being a bully. Not because he has any knowledge that Tobey Maguire has gained superhuman strength from a radioactive spider, but rather just as a general life philosophy. Power, as Uncle Ben would have had us understand it, could be physical strength, wealth, intelligence, or any combination of traits or attributes that regular Joes like you or I could possess. But Tom Holland's Aunt May says this having known since the end of Spider-Man Homecoming that her nephew is, well, Spider-Man. It's divorced from the everyman context it normally has existed in, and instead is inextricably based in her knowledge of Tom Holland's spider powers. Now, yes, yes, Aunt May does indeed do community kitchen or care stuff with Feast, which is an institution I only recognise from seeing it in the Spider-Man video game by Insomniac, and while that informs this version of the great power line, there's no untangling it from its superpowered context, and therefore it makes it feel less universal and less applicable to all of us. But moreover, it also runs deeply contrary to the events of the film. I mean, are the villains not also blessed with great power of a sort, whether it's the high wattage kind that Electro possesses or Doc Ock's own genius intellect? But in the end, save for Ock, all of their powers are taken away and stripped from them, even though, for some of them, the powers are not the source of their homicidal tendencies, at least as far as I can see. Like, I get with Norman Osborn, the Green Goblin formula drove him bonkers, and can logically follow that reversing that might give him back his sanity, but what about Electro? I mean, I didn't see the Amazing Spider-Man film, the second one, that is, in which he debuted, but from what I gather, his powers aren't the cause of his desire to fry Andrew Garfield's Spider-Man with 10,000 gigawatts of technically renewable energy. So what about, you know, just trying to rehabilitate him? For that matter, what about Flint Marko, aka the Sandman? He and Tobey Maguire came to understanding at the end of Spider-Man 3, and the latter forgave the former, yet here he wants to kill him? Why? What some of these villains need is not some sort of cure that can just be injected into them, but fucking therapy. And last I checked, Spider-Man's many talents did not extend towards talking to people on brown couches. This is one of the places where the script feels at its clunkiest, because of course we need to fight at the end of the film with the three Spider-Men on one side and the villains on the other. So even though it makes no sense for anyone but Green Goblin and Electro to want to fight them, everyone does in the end, and everyone is cured of their powers except for Doc Ock, which does make sense in his case, but otherwise it all feels very forced and also in opposition to the great power, great responsibility moral, because in the end, that only seems to apply to Spider-Man and not the villains, and silly, not the audience, based on how Aunt May describes it, at least to me. Part 2, Forgetting the Wrong Things. I think at this point, the criticism of the Tom Holland Spider-Man films, that his character essentially serves as private security for Stark Industries, and that his villains were Stark Industries workers who got screwed over through no fault of their own, I think that's fairly well known, and in my own opinion, valid. Indeed, there's been a meme floating around social media of Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man that just parodies the scene where he says Little Goblin Jr. to James Franco's Harry Osborn, just with him instead saying Little Iron Man Jr. to Tom Holland's Spider-Man. That meme is a great encapsulation of one of the main issues with the Tom Holland Spider-Man films, that Tony Stark's shadow lingers odiously and heavily over everything. I'm going to go on record here with something that I have no hard evidence for, but fuck it. I'm of the opinion that the modern kiss-the-ring mentality that so many foolish people have for billionaire tossers like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, I believe that stems from those same people uncritically venerating Robert Downey Jr.'s Tony Stark because he's cool, he's smart, and he's awesome, at least as the films present him. He's also a bellend, but I will credit Tony for at least building and making his own tech with his bare hands as opposed to, say, Musk, whose only notable invention is disguising the origin of his wealth being from apartheid South Africa. But I digress. I agree with the criticisms that Tony Stark is a net negative for the modern Spider-Man movies, and the continuing worship of his character, even in No Way Home, feels irritating and cringeworthy. I mean, the guy doing the sign of the cross and the post-credits scene, his mention of his name? No thanks. No. But I am also of the opinion that one can easily turn a perceived weakness in a story to a strength if you acknowledge it head-on. The Iron Man Jr. meme has some truth to it, so why not make that part of the text and have it be something that Tom Holland has to overcome? This could even be something that Tobey Maguire and Andrew Garfield both offered their perspectives on. Indeed, Tobey Maguire initially had a friendly relationship with Willem Dafoe's Norman Osborn that in some ways parallels Tom Holland's relationship to Tony Stark, so why not utilize that in the script? Draw comparisons, bring up similarities and differences, really make the best of the continuity you've been given here. Missed opportunities aside, the creators of No Way Home do seem to be aware of the necessity of solving this problem of Tony Stark's long-looming legacy, given how the film concludes. For context, in order to prevent all of reality and space-time from being flushed down the drain due to the botched spell that brought the alternate universe Spider-Men and their villains to the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Tom Holland asked Doctor Strange to remove him from the memories of everyone who has ever known him. That includes Mary Jane, Ned, the Pope, the Avengers, Happy Hogan, J. Jonah Jameson, the last person he bought coffee from, everyone, everywhere. But before I go any further on this, I need to note something important. In fiction, magic is arguably one of the most pliable and elastic means of making events happen. It's easier to use magic, quote-unquote, as a means of advancing a story, as it requires very little setup of its own logical consistency and internal rules versus technology or even politics. It's just something we as audiences are more primed to accept. That doesn't mean that logical consistency isn't important in magic-heavy settings, of course, but it should be noted, therefore, that magic as a means of story advancement has it easiest for making the events happen that you want to happen. And additionally, I should reiterate that the end reason of why all events happen in fiction is because the author wants them to happen, not because of any diegetic in-universe reason. Therefore, with this in mind, we could see the memory wipe as a means for the writers of No Way Home and the stewards of future MCU Spider-Man films doing this as a means to factory reset Tom Holland's Spider-Man, to remove the existing baggage of his time with the Avengers and the spacefaring universe nonsense backstory that's explicitly referenced by Doctor Strange and others in the first act of the film. That's not to say it's completely devoid of narrative function in of itself, as the idea of owning your actions and consequences crops up a few times in the film, which, like, I do get, I really do get it. But the thing is, removing Tom Holland's relationships with MJ and Ned is needlessly cruel, and it deletes one of the legitimately good things that the MCU Spider-Man films brought to the table on their own. Even in this film, their banter and interplay is absolutely fantastic, so removing that seems like an own goal, except that the football is a bundle of dynamite, I guess. If there was anything that the filmmakers should have done with the opportunity afforded by magic as a kind of narrative stem cell, if you will, it should have been to tackle the Tony Stark legacy issue head on. If reboots and retcons are currency, No Way Home spends a hell of a lot on the completely wrong thing, in my opinion. Amusingly though, there are actually two moments in the film where it seems somewhat critical of Tony Stark's legacy and or character, albeit in the first case only mildly, and in the second unintentionally, at least as I see it. The first, of course, is that it's confirmed on the news that the drones seen in the London attack in Far From Home were Stark technology kit, which I'm glad is openly acknowledged given how fucking stupid the giant angry drone beehive in space was. Given all of Tony's previous history with Ultron and the fear that his weapons might be misused, it's admittedly brief and hardly judges Tony himself, but it is there. The second moment is that near the film's conclusion, post-mass Men in Black neuralizer memory wipe spell bollocks, Happy Hogan visits Aunt May's grave where Tom Holland also is, and mentions how he had a friend and how he remembered what he stood for. That friend, of course, is Tony Stark, and one of the things he stood for was attempting to murder Bucky Barnes, the Winter Soldier, at the conclusion of the film Captain America: Civil War. So for context, Barnes, while under a form of long-running mind control and mental conditioning, murdered Tony's parents in 1991. At the end of Civil War, he's kind of one-third the way to being deprogrammed, and as Cap notes, it wasn't his fault as he was under mind control, but Tony doesn't care. And I get that. He's wrong to try and turn Barnes into chunky salsa by shooting him with missiles, but I understand why he came to that desire to kill him. So consider this. In No Way Home, Tom Holland wants to kill Norman Osborn for killing Aunt May. But isn't Norman in kind of a similar situation as Barnes? After all, the film makes clear that the Green Goblin persona sometimes takes control of him, and therefore Norman shouldn't be held responsible for the actions the Goblin persona does while in the driver's seat. The fact that Barnes and Osborn are also enhanced by super soldier formulas of one kind or another is just another incidental similarity, but it does add weight to this comparison. So in the end, Tom Holland has the chance to kill the Green Goblin, and nearly does, but he's stopped by Tobey Maguire, who is then stabbed by the Goblin. Rather ineffectually stabbed, by the way, but whatever, that's not important. Holland is given the chance to kill Osborn now, and arguably has even more incentive to do so, given he could have potentially killed Tobey Maguire. But instead he chooses to cure the Goblin. He chooses mercy. In contrast, in Captain America: Civil War, Stark does not cease his attempts to murder Bucky once. He instead is forcibly stopped by Captain America. At that point in the film, I'm not of the opinion Tony could be talked out of it or would have had a change of heart. Either he would lose the fight with Cap, or alternatively he would have won and killed Bucky. In that way, the ability to show mercy to a killer after losing a loved one to them, that is one way that Holland proves he is superior to Tony Stark. Unintentional though it may be in the film, it's there at least. Part 3, putting the bands back together. I've been broadly negative for the past two parts, so I think it's a good idea to end on a very high note. But first, a mild digression. Did you see the 2017 film Logan by James Mangold? It was the final film featuring Wolverine from the X-Men as played by Hugh Jackman. And without going into spoilers for those who haven't seen it, I thought it was a pretty near flawless send-off for Jackman's portrayal of that character. across over a decade and a half of X-Men movies, which I want to emphasize there. Speaking as someone who has seen most of these films in the cinema as they were released while I was growing up, that gave Jackman's finale an extra layer of poignancy for me personally. It was really touching. I bring this up because I had a similar feeling towards the conclusion of No Way Home. Not because the actual events of both films were similar, nor were the films similar in tone or style, but rather because No Way Home, like Logan before it, made use of nearly two decades of my own personal history to conclude Tobey Maguire's story in a way that I found very satisfying. But I'll get to that in a bit. First, I should address Andrew Garfield. Not him specifically, I mean, unless he's listening, in which case, hi. But rather, I mean his appearance in this film and my own non-history of the amazing Spider-Man films that he appeared in previously. Like I mentioned before, I haven't seen either film at the time of recording, but I did learn with a bit of research that the second of those films was written by Roberto Orci and Alex Kurtzman, two clowns who are the only men on the planet who could be convicted of physically assaulting a word processor. Their cinematic scripting atrocities include the Transformers films made by Michael Bay and the first two modern Star Trek movies, including the rusted, dead shipwreck of a film that was Into Darkness. So, while not having not seen the second film, I can say I'm not surprised its critical reception was as poor as it was given these two dickheads were responsible for the script. I say this because, having not seen these films, Andrew Garfield puts in a great performance in No Way Home, and without having their events in mind, his delivery of his more emotional beats worked for me in spite of that lack of knowledge. I am aware that he was written in the first Amazing Spider-Man film to be a more cool version of Peter Parker, in what I believe to be a cynical, marketing demographic-driven move, but in No Way Home, he really does fit the cool Peter Parker well, without feeling obnoxious, false, or overshadowing the other two Spider-Men. It feels natural, and it ultimately feels like a fucking crime to me that he was denied the opportunity to act out a good quality script, as he's clearly well suited to his iteration of Spider-Man when placed in better hands. But of course, there is Tobey Maguire, and his reprisal of his own version of Spider-Man and the scenes with him were probably the highlight of the film for me as someone who was just a teenager when the first Spider-Man movie came out in the awkward post-Batman and Robin comic book movie post-apocalypse era. Maguire has apparently gone on record saying he didn't want his version of Peter Parker to divulge too much information on what happened to him after the end of Spider-Man 3, and I do think this was the right move, but the details we do get are very welcome, including confirmation that he and Kirsten Dunst MJ are still together and ultimately had a happy ending that required hard work, but a happy ending nonetheless. That was neat to hear. The real crowning moments, though, are Maguire's interactions with Alfred Molina's Doc Ock. In Spider-Man 2, Ock serves initially as a mentor figure to Tobey Maguire before being driven insane in the accident that, well, it led to him being afflicted with what I'm going to call retroactive nominative determinism. Imagine saying that quickly a couple of times back to back. But anyway, whereas Osborn's green tea-flavoured super soldier formula drove him homicidally insane to the point where it wasn't possible to save him in Spider-Man 1, in Spider-Man 2, Ock was always written in that film to potentially come back from the brink. So once his faulty AI chip is repaired and he regains his sanity, his turn to hero in the final action scene is really great to see. But of course, there's also the moment where he and Toby reconcile, including a wonderfully delivered line by Alfred Molina where he comments that Toby is all grown up. The decade and a half wait for that moment made it all the sweeter, and it's why No Way Home in places exceeds simply being a things you know film. By building on what's come before and offering closure on dangling plot threads and character conflicts like this. Even Doc's little moment where he holds an arc reactor and gets to see his dream of the power of the sun in the palm of my hands, as he says it, that he gets to see that fulfilled, if not in his timeline then in another, that's great! And all credit has to go to both Alfred Molina and Willem Dafoe for being incredible in their performances, with both bringing the necessary wickedness to their villainous streaks while also giving their characters the humanity the script requires in its quieter moments. Dafoe in particular feels like he just walked right back into the Norman Osborn Green Goblin role as if it was yesterday, and making it look easy with the kind of grace that Alex Winter brought back to the titular bill of Bill and Ted Face the Music despite being away from the role for decades. Dafoe plays Osborn as the truly broken, wounded man he is, giving him a vein of vulnerability when in command of his own senses, and then seamlessly moving into the cackling viciousness of the Goblin as needed. Both Molina and Dafoe are, of course, long-running legendary actors with works between them, such as Molina's Prick Up Your Ears and Chocolate, or Dafoe's Platoon and The English Patient, to name just a few, and both bring their talents to bear in this film with rousing success. Now, I can't speak to each person's individual response to this film, as I think it'll depend on if you've seen the previous Spider-Man films, and also when you first saw them is also key. But as someone who saw the Sam Raimi trilogy but not the Mark Webb duology, I think it can please both people who saw the films and those who didn't. The banter and interplay between the three Peter Parkers is also a shining moment for the film, including showing an often ignored talent of the characters' common backstory in that they're all scientists, and they're all creating the necessary cures from scratch in Tom Holland's high school laboratory, which is really, really great. It isn't as good as Spider-Verse's interplay, but it works differently by using that established near two decades of Spider-Man films to deliver this fond send-off for Maguire and Garfield, while affirming Tom Holland's own able capability in playing the role. For all the film's previous faults that I've talked about, it's more than compensated for it in how good these moments are between the three Spider-Man. Even the Great Responsibility mantra, flubbed in its interpretation as it is, in my opinion, was used very well as the introductory bridge between the three Spider-Men when they first meet. In the end, I suspect this is why you went or would go to see the film, and in that respect, No Way Home achieves what it sets out to do without being manipulative or overly checklisty. Bringing in Maguire and Garfield was the star, and a lesser interpretation of the film would have done that just so they could have the fight with the villains, but it gave them closure as characters and, in a way, as actors. That I can definitely respect. Part 4. Conclusion. There's more I could discuss here, such as, say, Electro's extremely clunky and tacky "I thought you were a Black Spider-Man" line, which was only really used for an oblique Miles Morales reference, or the plot hole that perhaps, just maybe, Tom Holland should have had Doctor Strange make people forget about Quentin Beck, i.e. Mysterio, instead, but I'll leave it there. Overall, No Way Home is not on par with Into the Spider-Verse, but I'm alright with that because, as a capstone to nearly 20 years of Spider-Man films, it works for me. It managed to rise above what otherwise could have been a cynical and cheap nostalgia cash-in to actually round off the previous Spider-Man characters and actors, giving them one final flourish that made the whole affair worthwhile. I just hope that the hard reset of the film's climax is worth it in the long run story-wise, and that Tom Holland is given the chance to do more Spider-Man films that now will fully test his merit, both in terms of the character he plays and him as an actor without all of the previous continuity baggage. Anyways, that's that. Next time, Halo Infinite. If you enjoyed this audio essay, either for its long, laborious monologuing, or its efficacy as a sleeping aid, you can thank me by dropping a Ko-Fi at ko-fi.com/Wari-show, or just taking the usual social media buttons wherever you find them. Otherwise, that'll be it from me. Good night.